Sometimes, when I'm in search of something, lost paperwork, my keys, or for something less available to being found, patience, a sense of calm, I call the thing that I am doing, the searching, Bernarding. Bernarding. My dad, James Hennessy, was raised Catholic. As a young man at his confirmation, a time of initiation when he would choose his middle name, he chose the name Bernard, after the saint, Saint Bernard. And he became James Bernard Hennessy. I was not raised Catholic, and I did not know who Saint Bernard was. So as a child, wondered why my lean, quiet, even shy father took the name of a weighty Saint Bernard, the canine with a huge head, a drooling desire to please, and a hankering to pull things out of the snow. I decided to focus on the fact that my father had named himself, which meant something about him. Bernard, the joy in the search for it, at the risk of not finding it yet. Bernarding. Although identity is not equivalent to biography, it's Father's Day, so I will tell you a little more about my dad. The story begins in Liverpool, England, and winds up in the left nostril of Montana. We'll pick up on that later. Our worship theme this month is beauty, and I'd like to talk about some connections between beauty and justice. Author Elaine Scarry explores this connection in her book, On Beauty and Being Just. This is her definition of beauty. Beauty is that which makes us pause and catch our breath in a moment of suspended delight and profound feeling. It causes what she describes as radical decentering. We no longer feel that we ourselves are the center of the world, and we willingly cede our ground to the thing that is before us. Think of the first image of the earth from space, a beautiful and decentering image that helped start a global environmental justice movement. Scarry uses the definition of justice offered by philosopher Rawls. In his definition, justice is defined in terms of fairness, in particular, fairness as a symmetry of everyone's relation to each other. She explores the linguistic connection too, the synonym fair. In issues of beauty, fair face, fair vistas, fair skies. In concerns of justice, fair arrangements and fair playing fields. Scarry then looks at the interconnectedness between the symmetries of fairness, equal distribution of power and force, stewardship of the common good, and authentic accounting for the dynamics of difference. If you were reading this in print, it would have a little asterisk that said, James B. Hennessy found this particularly interesting. I will confess that at times the book read like the struggle to untie a knot in an old shoestring with your teeth. It is a difficult read, but I love the urgency and the language she brings to the subject. I have felt what she describes. Being decentered by something I felt was beautiful, and wanting to protect it, and replicate its influence on me in an effort to get to the truth of it. Part of the difficulty in reading the book is that in our culture is tied up in a very old and painful knot. Our system of justice is broken, injurious, asymmetrical. Our systems of care are unequal. Beauty not only assists in addressing injustice, Scarry argues, but it is crucial to heal us and to help us recenter our attention to the ideals of equality. We have ignored that beauty makes the heart beat faster. It makes life worth living. And it comes to us with no work of our own, then leaves us prepared to undergo a giant labor. Scarry suggests the labor is the work of justice. Liverpool, England, mid-1940s. An 800-year-old city that has been relentlessly bombed in the war. It's home of the Beatles, 700,000 other people, and my dad. In his mid-20s, and feeling he'd rather be in Ireland, his ancestral home. You may have heard of Speaker's Corner, an area where public speaking, debate, and discussion takes place, sometimes with people standing on a soapbox. One Friday night, my dad walked down to Speaker's Corner, not an unusual thing for him to do, and was taken by the sound of American voices talking about God, both a place and a person of interest. With years of catechism and seminary under his belt, he asked the two young Mormon missionaries a lot of questions, most of which, to his surprise, they answered. After coming back a few more times, my dad proposed a deal. If the Mormons from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints would meet the Catholic priest from his parish, my dad would read the Book of Mormon, their sacred text. Everything was going according to plan. Whose plan? I'm not sure. My dad would say his, the missionaries would say theirs, and the priest had ever higher opinions. But the Mormon missionaries and the Catholic priest did meet, and my dad did read the book. And from his knees, with an open heart, he asked if the book was true. He received his answer. And for the rest of his life, my dad described that moment as the most beautiful, and the experience as one that fixed in him a view of the world as it was and as it could be. My dad was baptized a Mormon. Salt Lake City, late 1950s. James and Fern, my mom, are embracing the challenges of their Mormon faith and the realities of what will become, by 1969, a family of 10. In addition to them both having leadership roles at church, they are doing what people do: look for work, affordable housing, safe places for their kids, a sense of belonging, and some adventure. Before my dad, the transformative experience in Liverpool remained incomplete. He felt he needed to go deeper into the young history of Mormonism, back to its origins. We're back to the left nostril, Montana, 1972 to 1980. Humans see faces in objects. Picture in your mind a map of the U.S. Now find Montana. Panhandle of Idaho on the left, stacked Dakotas on the right, wide Wyoming beneath and Canada above. Montana is a face in profile looking west. My hometown is there in the left nostril, a place more or less proofed against the intellectual and emotional influences of the outside world. A community of 500 people, Mormon fundamentalists, living the principles of the United Order, or plural marriage, a practice my parents did not participate in. This was the single most beautiful landscape I have ever called home. And those 8 years were the most complicating of my life. And for my dad, too. He took us there because he thought it was the right thing to do. And it fell in the path that he began walking once he stood up from kneeling in prayer long ago in Liverpool. And we left Montana, I think, because it turns out that even when everyone around you prays to the same God, eats from the same community garden, and shares all worldly goods, things still don't divide easily into truths and symmetries of fairness. Systems of justice and care can be broken no matter the size or particular focus of a community. We return to Salt Lake and the more upbeat practices of modern Mormonism. And we still have friends that live in Montana. I love my dad and the life he led. I wish I hadn't been there to experience all of it with him. But that is not a sentiment unique to me or any child about their parent. My daughters will back me up on that. Portsmouth, New Hampshire, 2003 to present, to this very minute. I started attending South Church in 2003. My dad died in 2006. Although 3 years seems like enough time to have a conversation about the church you and your family are attending, in our case, it wasn't. Though we did have a go at it. On a trip to Utah, Dad and I talked about Unitarian Universalism's fourth principle, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, and the first of six sources, direct experience of that transcending wonder and mystery, affirmed in all cultures, which moves us to a renewal of the spirit and an openness to the forces which create and uphold life. Lacing his fingers together and placing his hands on the table between us, he gave a slight smile and harumphed, a sound that embroidered the silence that followed with approval. The idea of a living faith got me through those South Church doors, but it was the religious education program that kept me coming back. And not only because in my own coming-of-age years, I was a character in an unbelievable story that was entirely true. The OWL program decentered me, or recentered me. Our whole lives, honest, accurate information about sexuality changes lives. Could there be a better example of attempting to balance beauty and justice than offering young people honest, accurate, even humorous information in thoughtful conversations about autonomy and agency and how we can care for it, and how you can care for your body and mind and for the body and minds of others too. I never pitched OWL to Dad. But if you put your hand to your ear, you're welcome to do it with me. You can hear my dad attending to a type of silence that takes a lot of effort to maintain. So I put my hand on my heart, because in the context of a pained and unjust world, to be moved to care for bodies and minds of others, as well as your own, is just plain beautiful. I often look back at that time in Montana as the time I understood with my whole self how interconnected and interdependent we are as people to each other and to this earth. And for that understanding, I am most grateful. Elaine Scarry, in her complicated little book, makes a most important observation. The opposite of beauty is not ugly. It is injury. There are so many wounds. Poet and philosopher John Donahue. There is a place inside of you that neither time nor space nor no created thing can touch. What that means is identity is not equivalent to biography. And that there is a place in you where you have never been wounded. And there's a still assuredness in you. There is a seamlessness in you. And where there is a confidence and a tranquility in you. And beauty and love is how you get there. Don't worry, I'll read that again. These past two Sundays, we have heard from our senior youth and coming of age groups, both offering services of such sweet and powerful kindness and clarity of heart. Beauty is about becoming. The Greek root of the word is calling. When other things become more important, O'Donohue says, beauty invites you, calls you to yourself, and you sideline yourself by accepting the invitation, and you are happy about that. Be willing, be beautifully willing to seed the ground on which you stand. With all this talk about beauty, some of you may be wondering where the Mary Oliver poem is. I don't have one. Instead, I will ask the question she asks 100 times in 100 different poems. How will you let beauty change you? And this from James Baldwin in his book, A Fire Next Time, about devastating racial injustice. The question remains, what shall we do with all this beauty? We are always shaping the world by loving what we love. Beauty not of our own making, calling us to become who we are, whole, alive, free. I will keep accepting the invitation. I will keep Bernarding. Thank you.